Today's episode is brought to you by the Atlanta Vision Institute. The Atlanta Vision Institute was the first in Georgia to use SMILE, the most advanced laser eye surgery procedure. This procedure is done with a high-tech precision laser. It's simple, takes about 6 to 8 minutes in its entirety. It's an easy recovery, requiring minimal post-op care. Most people are amazed at how effortless it is. You're going to experience substantially improved vision just a few hours after this surgery. Dr. Ashraf was on staff at Johns Hopkins University. He's board certified, and he's completed over 40,000 LASIK procedures. So go check out the Atlanta Vision Institute. Check this out. You can mention my name and get 20% off a consultation. To learn more, go to atlanta2020.com/Matt. That's me, M-A-T-T. atlanta2020.com/Matt. Go check out the Atlanta Vision Institute at atlanta2020.com. Welcome back to the Atlanta Podcast. I am your host, Mappy Davis. It's a gorgeous Monday here in the ATL. I hope you're enjoying whatever it is that you're doing. Hope you're enjoying John Albrell, my new buddy, the episode we just put out. I want to tell you about today's program in just a minute, but just want to catch up in general and let you know that I'm excited. I've got some new things in the works, a new place to record perhaps. You'll be hearing more about that later. It'll make this awesome sound sound even better. Super excited about that. But yeah, man, let's just get right into it. Let's get into today's show with John Carr, Black Nerd. John Carr from Dad's Garage. I went and saw Black Nerd at Dad's Garage, my first ever show at Dad's Garage. I don't know if you guys know this about me, but I am a married guy with a bunch of kids, 3 kids to be exact. And I don't get out a ton to evening events. When my wife and I do get a sitter, we tend to just kind of go low key. So we'll go eat somewhere and chill. I mean, we've gone like to just get coffee or whatever. Like we just, if we get a night away and we get a sitter, we don't do a lot of stuff, but whenever we do like events, we're always like glad we did. So, I mean, I'm trying to think of the last live performance we saw together. Years ago, we went to, the name of that Christmas show, it always comes around, David Sedaris. Sorry, I'll think of it later. We saw that years ago. We saw Billy Crystal's play up in the Cobb Energy Center. Again, that might have been 10 years ago. God, where does the time go? Anyhow, so I had seen John at the Nerdlanta show / podcast. He seemed like a cool guy. I wanted to learn more about him. I went to the show first so that I asked some questions. You cannot see the show until they bring it back. It is currently not performing. But I don't think that matters. I think you still get a gist of who the man is. And we talk about the play a fair amount and what I got out of it. And it's just cool to talk to really talented people. What can I say? And John is a super talented people. And another ATL connection that I'm glad I made. All right, John Carr, away we go.
Do you want to tell everybody where we are? Like to give sure. A little input and you got to put this close to your mouth, though.
Yes, absolutely.
There we go. Tell people where we are right now, this moment.
All right, we are in Dad's Garage Theater, and we are currently sitting in the rehearsal hall where all the practices happen.
This is where the practices happen?
Yeah, yep. We rehearse everything. It's an interesting thing about this room. It is the same space as the square footage as the stage upstairs. So we do all of our stage blocking and stuff down here because we have improv shows that go up on upstairs.
I was going to say, why not do it in the actual...
Yeah, because we're one of the few theaters that has something going on in the main stage pretty much every single night.
Okay, so let's start with you. I think we're about the same age. I can't remember if I asked you this or
not. I'm 38.
Okay, well, you are a little bit younger than me.
Yeah.
I thought we were closer to the same age. Where did you go to high school?
I was homeschooled.
Okay.
Yeah. I was, the joke we always say, I was homeschooled by traveling Christian clowns, which is absolutely true. Like that's
your parents were like missionaries?
Yeah, well we were we went and did so if there was ever a big revival somewhere in America, they needed to do something with the kids, and so our family business was we would go into a place, do puppets, clowns, magic tricks for the kids while the big revival thing was happening. So we'd perform in front of 300-400 kids at a time.
How do you feel about Billy Graham's passing?
It's a it's mixed feelings about that kind of thing. Like as a person, I think he did a lot of cool things. He was I believe a good person at heart. Some of his political views I think were problematic, and there's some issues with that. But I think, you know, he was one of those guys that, like, I'll give him credit because he tried. There are a lot of those guys in those positions that don't even give an effort to try to, like, reach across the aisle. He's one of the few.
Well, so, you know, I grew up, as I said, a little bit older than you, and I feel like the televangelist was hitting his or her stride.
Oh yeah,
in like the '80s. Mm-hmm. So, you had Tammy Faye and what's his name?
Yeah, the Bakers.
Yeah, the Bakers.
Yeah.
You had Billy Graham. You had, oh man, who are the other ones?
Paul and Jan Crouch. I don't know if you remember the 700
Club.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's long since been talked about, but my wife and I just last night or two nights ago were flipping through or the cable came on, and sure enough, there's this guy, you know, earnestly and sincerely, like, why you need to send him money. And we got mad because we know that there's some older, probably Southern folks,
yeah,
who were like, he's going to make my problems go. And he had like a special thing around it. It was like, it wasn't 2018, so send me $2,000. It was something 88, and you need to send $88. And it was just kind of like, it's the oldest thing in the world, but yet, yeah, it's like still happening. And like, I think people don't think it does because we're such a technological age or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I was around, like, when we were traveling around, we were at that height of like the kind of the, what's the good word for it?
The Beatlemania.
The Beatlemania, the money preacher sort of thing. And so like for us, it was kind of that weird thing where like, we weren't super into it, but we loved working with kids. We love like teaching them basic, like, hey, be nice to people. Like, you know, be.
Is that good, what they were, like little allegories? Of, like,
yeah,
nice,
yeah.
So
it was all just like the cheesiest sort of like little magic tricks and little puppet shows and just teaching basic decency to children. And it was super fun and great, but at the same time, like, yeah, we got to see the behind the scenes of a lot of that kind of stuff. And I think that's a lot of what made me change a lot of ideas and thoughts.
And were you nervous? Like, were you just a natural in front of crowds?
Oh yeah. Yeah. We were kind of raised in just performing. So I've been doing it since a little kid. So I'm pretty comfortable in front of crowds. And it was great because it was all simple. And it was great being a kid and getting to write your own sketches and come up with your own puppet sketches and all that kind of stuff.
But you are self-proclaimed black nerd.
Yes.
So how did that fit in with being in that whole traveling?
Oh, I mean, well, that's exactly, it's like, so part of being a nerd would be like, I was homeschooled, which automatically puts you in a nerd category. But I was homeschooled because we traveled so much. My parents wanted to teach us while we're on the road. But at the time, we were actually, our home base was Los Angeles. I lived in Inglewood, California.
Inglewood!
Yep, in the height of the 90s when NWA was like at its peak.
Wow.
And I was 5 minutes from the Rodney King riots. I like drove through that. So it's that juxtaposition of that time period in that area. Combine that with you have a kid who was homeschooled, whose favorite movie was like Singing in the Rain. It was a big Gene Kelly fan who, you know, was into, you know, nerd stuff in the middle of Inglewood, California, in the height of like gang acting, Crips blood and all that.
Who exposed you to Gene Kelly?
Homeschooled. It was my homeschooled friends. That's the thing that like we were all little socially awkward children who found joy in weird small things like classic movies and wrestling and video games and that sort of thing.
I think it's hard for younger people to understand what being a nerd was because we are in this nerd is king culture.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right? Absolutely.
And to remember that it wasn't cool. You didn't want to be called that.
Yep.
Revenge of the Nerds was kind of it, right?
Right, yeah.
Like there are jocks and there are nerds, and you definitely don't want to be a nerd.
No.
You probably don't want to be as mean as those jocks over there.
Right, right.
But you definitely don't want to be
no
Arvid from head of the class.
Absolutely. And You and I think there's
do you remember Head of the Class?
Oh, I absolutely remember Head of the Class. Okay. Yeah, that was a classic sitcom. But you take all that those ideas of like being a nerd in the 90s and all that, then you add on top of that just what was going on culturally in Los Angeles with like that was the height of gangs and that was the height of gang warfare and that was the height of NWA and anger and violence and all those types of things. And so there's even more of an emphasis on being this like style and being cool. It was even more important in that area.
So did you like Ice Cube? I mean, we're like, what were your thoughts?
I mean, my thoughts were like, I didn't like it. Like, I didn't like the music. Well, first of all, I have to say, we were super religious coming up. So when I was at that time, I wasn't allowed to listen to secular music. So it was Stephen Curtis Chapman, Amy Grant. Those were the people that we were listening to because my parents didn't want us
to. Did Babbie Mason make it out there? Do you know who she is?
Yeah, I've heard the name, but I didn't listen to her when I was a kid.
She's on the list for me to get. She was actually my music teacher.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Her son is a drummer that I used to know. I
mean,
he's probably around somewhere. I should get him on the show, too. But anyway... Babbie Mason, yeah, and then she became like this famous gospel singer after she was my third grade music teacher, fifth grade music teacher, whatever it was.
Yeah, absolutely, and like that's what we listened. So like for me, like there are all these classic like hip hop and rap artists that I knew tangentially, even though they were like having those experiences five blocks from me.
That's kind of because I feel like we were all like sort of swept up in it because it became just sort of this national thing.
Absolutely. And my parents didn't want me to get involved in it.
And if you go back, I mean, I think most of those records do hold up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's been the interesting thing is like going back to like listening to music of my time period and being like finding those people that I do enjoy now because now I can listen to whatever I want.
So how old were you when the riots happened? Was it 92 or 95? When did the riots happen?
I believe it was 90. It was 92 or 93. Because I'm pretty sure it was around there. So I was probably, I was born in 79. So I was about 12, 13.
Okay.
Around that time, and I remember it specifically because we were just playing video games, and all of a sudden at 3 o'clock, it went black.
Like power went out.
Not the power, the sky.
Whoa!
The sky went out. It turned into nighttime for no apparent reason. We couldn't figure it out, and so we turned on the news, and what had happened was so many businesses were on fire and so many buildings were on fire that the soot blocked out the sky, and it was like driving through at midnight.
Were you scared?
Oh, we were absolutely scared, and it was also crazy because we had two white friends that were staying at our house, and we were just playing video games, and they lived in like some outskirt town, and so we literally... Once my parents figured out what was happening, we put them in the backseat of our car. We covered the white kids with a blanket so no one would see that we had white kids in our car.
Because you don't want your car to get attacked.
Exactly. And we just drove through Compton, California, and just got out of town for a couple of days while that was going through. And I always describe it. It's like that scene in Terminator 2 when everything's on fire and all that. That's what it looked like while we were driving through Compton, L.A. at that time.
That's insane, dude.
Yeah. Yeah. It was pretty crazy.
All right. So when did you leave L.A.?
I left L.A. when I was 21, right, because I got right out of right after high school. So I was actually probably like 18. Then I did an internship in Tulsa, Oklahoma for a couple of years. And then I moved to L.A.
What was the internship?
At the time, my track in life was to be a children's pastor. That's what I wanted to do. And so there's a couple of like those mega churches. Tulsa, Oklahoma is like mega church heaven. And so I went there to intern at some mega church.
Dude, isn't that where Oral Roberts was?
Yeah, they're right by Oral Roberts University.
That's the one I was trying to think of. Yeah. I couldn't think of one of the 80s preachers.
Yep, that's right near Oral Roberts University. Did a couple 2-year stint there. Came back to Atlanta to become the children's pastor for the second largest church in America for about a year.
And then what happened?
And then I discovered sex and booze. And I'm like, you know what? I want to do that.
Right. This seems more fun.
Yeah, it seems a lot more fun. And honestly, probably a lot more honest and upfront than that. So,
And then that was like bye-bye church.
Done.
And so then what?
So then I had to figure out what I wanted to do. Because like I had nothing like this. All my life I've been trained to be a children's pastor.
But you didn't have friends that were like a apostates or whatever.
Oh yeah, I had a whole like network of friends that were everybody wanted to be a preacher. That's the thing about being in church. Like what you're supposed to want to be is a preacher. No one thinks about if we're all preachers, who were we preaching to? But
excellent point.
No, yeah, no one thinks about that part. But it is like, and so we all had plans on being ministers and making our own mega churches and all that kind of stuff. And so there was definitely this disconnect. But at the same time, I never really felt connected to those friends that much. And so
it was like you knew something was missing.
Yeah, I knew something was missing. And so once I got disconnected from that, I was like, okay, now I get to try. Now I get to do stuff. So much in the Christian world is about, I'm telling you don't do this because it's bad, and you take that word, their word for it. And so there was the first time in my life I got to experience like the wild days, but like in my 30s. That's my rebellious time was my
30s. You just got it like a decade later than most people.
Exactly. And I got to just experience stuff for myself and figure out what is bad and what isn't based on my personal experience.
Yeah, and you know, I have kids now, mm-hmm. and I am excited and worry at the same time, mm-hmm. because all that stuff is coming,
yeah.
right? So like first heartbreak, mm-hmm. and bad jobs and like all that stuff is coming, and there's nothing I can do about it but like watch them go through it.
Yeah.
And you know, at the time, you know, it seems like the worst fucking thing in the world,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Like all, like when you're 13 to 50, whatever the hell you
yeah.
are, the whole world is like, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that's what's great about like, and being like working with kids and that sort of thing is like a lot of parents want to protect their kids from those bad experiences and all that kind of stuff. But who you are as a person and as an adult is determined by how you deal with bad situations when things aren't going well. So it's great that, you know, your 14-year-old is like falls in love with a girl and gets his heart broken because you can help him deal with what that experience is. So when he's actually in love and for real, he knows how to deal with that, right?
Right.
Instead of protecting your kids and being like, no, nothing bad can happen
right.
to you. And then they don't know. That's why I love like sports for kids and that sort of thing. Cause like you need to learn what it's like to lose and to like try really hard and it fail. And this is the time to like work through that now. So when it happens, when you're an adult, you know how to deal with it.
Right.
Yeah.
So what year did you get to Atlanta?
I got to Atlanta. Let's see. I've been here for 14 years. So I've got to Atlanta, I guess it would be 06, 05, 06, somewhere around there.
Wait a minute. What year is it now? 2018?
Yeah, 2018. So maybe like 04. Doing math backwards.
I know. It's like
hard. Yeah.
I always think 2004 was like 5 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
But it turns out it's 2018.
Yes, exactly.
And it was 14 years ago.
Yeah, so like 2004.
And so you're not going to be a preacher. So now, like, what'd you do for work?
For a year, I did everything. Like if someone presented, and that was my other thing, was I had been in that church bubble for so long too, I didn't have a lot of experiences. So I made a commitment that for 1 year, if someone invited me to a thing, regardless of whether I thought I was going to like it or not, I went and did it. And so I directed rap videos for crappy rappers. I was a professional wrestler for a little while.
What?
I tried selling cars. I tried everything that I could get my hands on.
What was your wrestling name?
My wrestling name was Timmy McClendon, and my gimmick was that I was a Make-A-Wish child who had wished to be a wrestler in this promotion. And so I was this kind of weakling sort of guy that you felt sorry for, and then the bad guy wrestler would come in and just beat the crap out of me, and then the good guy wrestler would come in and save me, and we'd work together and overcome the bad guy, and it would be this heartfelt moment.
Did you watch wrestling as a kid?
Oh, yeah. I loved wrestling as a kid.
Who did you like as a kid?
I was absolutely a Rock fan.
Okay.
Yeah. I love The Rock. Yeah. But it was never wrestling that interested me. It was cool because the wrestling group that I worked with, some of the guys were improvisers. And they always talked about wrestling's not about like people punching and flips and all that kind of stuff. It's about storytelling. And that's the thing that I've always been attracted to, is like, how can I tell a story? And wrestling is just telling a story physically.
Do you watch wrestling now?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I pay attention now. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm from, again, the heyday.
Mm-hmm.
And then I missed everything.
Right, yeah.
Right? I missed The Rock. I missed Sting. I mean, that was all happening in the background.
Right, right.
But about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, I started watching with my son. And now I'm all in again.
Yeah.
And, well, I say all in. You know, I'll watch like so Monday and Tuesday night it's on.
Right, right.
And I'll watch usually probably not every week, but pretty close.
Yeah.
I do fast forward a lot.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Intros have gotten too long.
Yep.
Certain matches, I'm like, really feeling it.
And Raw's like 3 hours. Like, who has 3 hours every week?
But see, this is what I don't understand. So, so talk to me about this, because I spent a year, like the first kind of year I spent watching it.
Right.
And, you know, there's the build up to SummerSlam.
Right.
Then there's the build up to Hell in the Cell. Mm-hmm. Then there's build up to WrestleMania. Everything's going towards WrestleMania, right?
Right.
WrestleMania is the big fucking Super Bowl.
Right.
The next day, we're back on Raw with new storylines.
Yeah.
And I'm like, these people got to take a break.
There's no off season.
Right?
Yeah.
So they've got to be getting hurt real bad.
Oh, yeah.
And they've got to be taking stuff to stay not hurt.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, I realize it's a gazillion dollar product, but they gotta cut it back.
They do. And you got to also take into it when we're seeing once a week, but then they're also doing live shows.
Oh, right.
Yeah, that aren't being televised, and they're still doing wrestling matches during the week.
This is what sold me for good. Mm-hmm. I went down to, was it Macon? Either Macon or Savannah. No, it wasn't that far. It was Macon or Augusta. Mm-hmm. And do you know who Charles Robinson is?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So I know Charles.
Oh,
I met
wow.
him through my other thing, which is obstacle racing.
Okay.
So he got us, like, in.
Oh,
like,
wow.
Like, backstage. And so first of all, I got to, like, see these people, mm-hmm. like, backstage.
Yeah.
And they all, everybody took the time to say hey to my kid.
Oh, wow.
And take pictures of my kid.
Wow.
Which is what, like, they're paid to do, but doesn't mean they have to do it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Super sweet to my kid. And then it made me appreciate the pageantry even more. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I'm backstage talking to them.
Right, right.
And you go, well, he is actually not that big. He's just a regular guy.
Mm-hmm.
But then the lights come on and the music comes on, right?
Yeah.
And they're
yeah.
larger than life. And here's the thing. That was not a full house.
Yeah.
And they are fucking giving it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, Charlotte Flair did her entrance right in front of me and my kid. You know, yeah. Natalia, I think it was, like, turn around, told my son to shut up. Made his life, right? And
yeah.
they give it. Like, they're like Bruce Springsteen, like, every freaking night.
Yeah.
And I was like, I have so much respect. If you are not watching professional wrestling, I dare you to watch it. It's amazing.
It's an art form. And the crazy thing about it is, like, those guys are, if you're in the WWE, that's the top. That's the ideal place. So what that means is, when they were starting out and, like, their first couple of years, they were doing that same thing, that same effort in front of 30 people.
Right.
And they were doing the flips and the bumps, and they're just, and there's something about it.
So, dude, that was the thing, which maybe this even got me. So, last year, mm-hmm. DCW, Dragon Con Wrestling.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I went thinking, like, this is going to be pretty good. I just started watching wrestling again. I'm like, this is going to be, and I was like, wait a minute. These guys are giving it, they're all
yeah.
just like, this is a show.
Yeah. Yeah,
I'm assuming absolutely. You were there.
I was there for like the first. I missed most of it, but I was there for a little bit. And like, I know some of the guys I used to wrestle with, like the Washington Bullets.
Right.
They were in my wrestling group when I was a wrestler. And there's a couple of other guys, and like one of the guys actually in the WWE now. And so yeah, and it was always amazing being backstage with these. And that's what I love about it is like. On stage, it's a lot of like, I hate this guy, I hate this guy. But backstage, there's this trust that you have to have to for someone to like physically put your body in danger when you're doing a flip or a body slam, and you have to let that person just put you out there, and you have to trust them. And that's the thing that's was always blew me away is you saw the good guys and the bad guys just like working it out, and you could see like the connection, and when the two guys were really connected and can do something amazing together, and they both really trusted each other, it's like that was cool. That was like watching like a great ballet, except there are punches and kicks involved.
Yeah, there's usually like a match, right? Like every night, there's like it's fine if someone needs to walk through.
Okay, yeah.
Like a match at any given thing that like. You're just like blown away by.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
like the turns, the twists.
Yeah.
Like this guy jumps off the top rope, then this yeah. guy does. Anyway, we can't go into wrestling too much. I am a wrestling fan though. So so let's talk about how you got here.
Okay.
To Dad's Garage.
Okay. So at the time I was working at the church, and I was working with kids. I was working as an assistant children's pastor, and it was a great job. I love working with kids. It was super fun working with kids, but working with kids, you have to be very aware of like what you're, especially as a single guy. Like when you have meetings, you got to make sure you have another person there. You have to be watching what you're saying, what you're doing, all these types of things. So I was just always very aware of everything that was happening around me. And so someone told me about improv classes, and improv classes were the one time in my week where I could say whatever I wanted. I could curse, I could make a dirty joke, I could flop around. I didn't have to care about if I was being offensive or weird. And so I did that for about a year, and then they asked me to join the cast. And when I kind of quit all the church stuff, this was like my rock.
You found your people.
I found my people. I finally felt like I fit in somewhere.
So you were just doing, were you doing classes or like what were you, or just like what were you doing?
I was just doing. Oh,
come on, John.
I'm so
we can
sorry.
Move. We can pause and move.
Okay. Can we pause and move?
Sure.
I was asking how you got like into the improv.
Yeah. So I was working with kids and I had to be so aware, and this was my
right. No, but I'm saying, were you just like, did you just like sign up for classes? Like, how did it go for you?
Yeah, I literally just signed up for classes. Well, what happened was I've been coming to Dad's Garage for a while, just coming to see shows. And I remember there was one moment I was in the audience and I was with a female friend of mine. And we were watching this show, and one of their improvisers was a guy with braces. He had like a afro, and like he was like one of those Jewish afro things, and like he just looked like the nerdiest guy in the world. And he was just amazing and hilarious. And I just remember her sitting next to me, and then leaning over for no real reason and saying, "Yeah, I'd have sex with that guy." And I was just like, "Well, I gotta take improv classes." And so I just started taking classes, and it was never a goal of like get on stage and perform and all that stuff. It was just therapy for me. And then I met friends and made friends, and this became my community, and I just kept hanging out until they put me on stage.
And so then what were you doing for work while you were still doing all this?
So I found a job at Coca-Cola, and I was a Coca-Cola polar bear. And so if you've ever been to the world of Coke and the giant polar bear that walks around, I was that guy for like 3 or 4 years. And at that time, I decided to go back to school.
Do you know Trey?
I do know Trey. Yeah.
Have you guys exchanged mascot stories?
We have. Holy cow.
Well, I just interviewed Trey not that long ago. He's awesome.
Yeah, he's great. He's great.
But I just think that's kind of funny that
That's, yeah. So, yeah. And so, like, I did that and went back to school to finish up my degree in marketing. And so, while I was doing polar bearing, and then I ended up getting the job here as the marketing director and been here ever since.
When, how long was that?
I've been here for about 4 years.
So, you were just doing shows and doing the marketing director thing?
So, yeah. So, currently, I'm doing, so, like, when I was the polar bear, I would do polar bear during the day, do shows at night.
Right.
And then now I'm the marketing director here. And so, now I do marketing and then walk upstairs and do shows.
All right. Well, I totally want to get to the show because I really liked it. Mm-hmm. Really liked it. But I want to talk about, so as long as I've been here, so I moved back to Georgia in, I can never remember. My daughter's 11. So that's what, 2007? Yeah. We moved here when she was little. And I feel like Dad's Garage has been, like, I've heard of it. It's been sort of omnipresent, like in town.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm not in the scene, as it were, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So I did stand up once upon a time, by the way. I was in LA for like 10 years.
Oh, wow.
Then I came back here. And I had gone to the Nerdlanta podcast.
Okay, yeah.
Because we started talking, and that's when I met you and heard about your... The point is that like I haven't been around like live theater that much.
Mm-hmm.
So the sticker that was on the table out there was Twin Head, and I've seen them a few times.
Right.
Love them.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
They're great.
Yeah. But I haven't been around live shows a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But it feels like Dad's Garage has just been sort of killing it, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, for like the better part. Like, so what is your... For our city, do you feel like is the goal like get more people to theater, keep giving sort of the audience that you have more choices, get more people than the Punchline or Relapse? Like, what is like, how do you see your job?
For us, I people always ask us like, who are you competing with?
Right.
That sort of thing. And we do stage plays, and so people are like, "Oh, do you compete with Seven Stages Horizon?" Like, no, we don't, and we do
improv. We used to be at Seven Stages.
We used to be at Seven Stages. Yeah, absolutely. And we do improv, and like, oh, so do you like compete with Relapse and The Village and all that? Like no, like we're not in competition with any of the. Our competition is Netflix.
Right.
That our
get people out of the fucking house.
Exactly. Get you off your butt and coming to see here, coming to see shows in a live theater. But the overarching goal and the thing that I love about this city as someone who grew up in LA, the thing I love about Atlanta is I feel like there's a underlying current with all the artists here in town that all we want to do is get Atlanta known nationally. And so as a community within the Atlanta arts community, we do that. But also as a theater, we're like, what can we do to punch through that glass ceiling? And that's why we bring in big celebrities to come in, partially to like have a big event and bring people out, but also just to be like, hey, big celebrity, check out what we can do here.
Right.
Look what we have here. Now go tell your LA friends about us.
Right.
Because like Atlanta is a great place with a lot of talent and we need more eyes on Atlanta.
Yeah, I just did an interview with my friend Zach who you're fine. People are always so who has become like the serious hip-hop photographer guy. And he came up with all those guys right when all that stuff happened.
Yeah.
Right. So the 10 years that I was gone, we became like this hip-hop center, and it kind of like that put Atlanta on the map.
Yep.
And so now it's like everything's I feel like everything else kind of stems from that.
Yeah.
Even though like the movie industry is a totally its own thing.
Right.
Nobody even thought of Atlanta for anything.
Exactly.
Right before that.
Exactly. And that's the idea of like no one's sitting, well, I'm sure there's probably some guy, but like most people aren't sitting there going like, oh man, Outkast got out and I didn't break out like that. No one's sitting there. Everyone's sitting like, yes, Outkast, you represent Atlanta. We're going to support you because you're exactly. talking about us. So everybody here wants everybody else to succeed.
Right.
Because the more of us that succeed in some level, the more it brings more eyes to us.
Right.
Whereas LA was exact opposite, where if you succeed, then you're taking my spot that I could have had or my commercial or.
Exactly. So I moved to Boston from here, mm-hmm. right? Because in 1996, there was no comedy here other than the Punchline in the Uptown Comedy Corner,
mm-hmm.
right? It wasn't like it is now. There's no fucking 1 a.m. secret show. There's no nothing.
Yeah.
Right. So I moved to Boston and then I moved to LA 3 years later. And it's not just, this is how I explain it to people, is that in Boston, you know, you get in the car, you drive to Rhode Island or some suburban town and you do the show, right? 3 to 5 of you, and it's kind of us against the world thing. There's maybe 200 of you in the whole like New England area.
Right, yeah.
You move to LA, and I try to explain to people, I'm now competing for stage time with a girl whose acting teacher told her to try stand-up.
Yep.
And Drew Carey, who was the biggest comic at the time. So yeah. I got to fight for stage time between those two. And I was not. I'm only fighting with fucking people that want to be comics in Boston.
Yes, absolutely.
And like do or die. Yes, some people come and go, but we all kind of do our thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just found this like old notebook of jokes and sets and like flyers and shit. And it's like, I realize everything happens the way it's supposed to happen, but maybe if I had to do it over again, I would have just stuck in Boston.
Yeah.
And worked hard and seen kind of what could happen there.
Yeah.
Because I think I just got lost in the sea of whatever in LA.
You absolutely do. And that's the thing, because I grew up growing up there, I thought I hated art. I thought I hated the arts because right. everything that I knew connected with stand-up, improv, acting, painting, like any sort of art, it was all like that, where it was all fighting for stage time and then half the people not even actually caring about that art. It was just a fast way to get on stage, to get seen by an agent, hopefully.
Right. Well, it's funny because like I don't even do stand-up anymore, but the few comics that I've interviewed are fascinated when I talk about doing stand up in like the late 90s, so the guy I brought, Christian, the guy mm-hmm. that I brought to the show,
yeah.
Cron Solo, shout out Cron Solo, trying to explain to him this concept of going to the post office with a box of VHS tapes, and he was like, "Oh my god!" His mind was blown, right?
Yeah,
I guess because he had grasped the concept that there wasn't YouTube, but he hadn't grasped the concept that one would have to
physically send
schlep those tapes.
Yeah,
like so. I remember distinctively, like in the post office in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Right there on whatever the fucking street it was on. Maybe Vine or Gower. I can't remember.
Yeah.
I don't know how well you remember Hollywood.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I remember people that like had VHS tapes in their trunk just in case they were at a restaurant and they saw somebody and they could slip them a videotape.
Right.
On their stuff.
So the other thing I was explaining to him was, and this is what's got me excited, is that going to that podcast taping and then seeing this, I honestly like forgot how much I enjoy, like, because as you know, laughing in a theater full of people versus being on the couch and laughing by myself or just with my wife, yeah, which those have their own place and time.
Right.
But to, it's just a different feeling that I've kind of forgotten about and that honestly I've been jaded to. Okay. Mm. So when you live in LA, yeah, again, something I said to Christian was, you get invited to so many things and you just pray it's not the worst piece of shit. Like, not that it's just not that it's good, but that it's not the worst thing horrible.
Right. Yeah.
Because you don't want that awkward moment afterwards.
Yeah.
Where you got to say something.
Yep.
And sometimes it was.
Yes.
Sometimes it is the biggest piece of shit.
It is.
And somebody gave me it, like somebody gave me a DVD, I remember once, or VHS once, and I was like, oh my God, I know he's going to ask me what I thought of this thing. So to come here and to see it and to see, and here's the other thing. When I saw that podcast, that's a room full of 20 people. And I forgot that a small crowd can be amazing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
A small room and a small crowd can be fucking awesome.
Yep. 20 people on your side is a beautiful
thing. We were howling in that room.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. It was so much fun. It was so great. And it was, and that's the thing about it, is like, that's why for me, it's kind of going back to that wrestling thing. It's that idea of like, yeah, it's 1,000 people, or maybe you're performing in front of like 30 people. But man, if you got 30 people that want you to be good, that are like, they want to laugh, they want to cheer, they want to be excited. Oh, there's no feeling like that where people are just, we're all on the same page. We're not fighting. We're just.
Yeah. And that's the, to, you know, I wanted to do, I've been, since I started the show, I thought, well, it's obvious I should do something live, right? Mm-hmm. Atlanta podcast, I should get Atlanta guests, we should do it. And I'm like, oh, I should get like, you know, City Winery or one of these cool, like, or here or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, when I saw that show, I was like, fuck it, I'm going to do a show with 20 people.
Yeah.
Like, let's just do it and see what happens,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
And let me ask you this, because somebody, I put the tickets on sale, mm-hmm, right? People are very excited. Nobody's buying the tickets yet. And somebody told me that we live in a world where that's not a thing anymore. People just fucking, like, they just buy it the night before online.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's, we have a 200 seat, and it drives me nuts as marketing director.
Right. Well, so let's talk about that.
We have a 200 seat auditorium, and we'll have like 20 tickets sold, and I will be freaking out because I'm like, we have 180 seats, and then 24 hours, it never fails, 24 hours, we get like 100, 150 ticket sales 24 hours before the event.
Because people have so many choices now?
Because people have so many choices, because people, honestly, and it's when you're directing or doing something where it's a 30 and under crowd. It's a very 30 and under thing, because so much of our lives now are instant. If I want to watch a TV show, I don't wait until 8 o'clock for the TV show to come on. I turn on Netflix and it's just there. And when I want something, it's there. So like for me, people send me Facebook invites all the time, and I'm like interested in everything because at 8 o'clock on Friday,
you want to be reminded.
I want to be reminded, and then at 8 o'clock on Friday, I want to go through all those things I said I was interested in and pick the one that I want the most.
At least shout out to Facebook. They are beating Evite because they took out maybe and just said interested.
Yep.
Maybe is the worst fucking thing in the world, because we know it means you're not coming.
You're right.
You going to come to my show this week? Maybe. Fuck you. That's a no. Just have the balls to tell me no. Come on, dude. I know you feel me on this.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
So I should not sweat that even though I only got to sell 25 seats,
no,
I've only sold two.
No.
And that the night before, I'll probably sell out.
Exactly. Yeah. People just come.
Okay, good.
Yes.
Okay, good. Because I don't want to, you know, again, it's like, you know how it is. It's like you're throwing a party that no one's going to come to.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So, all right. So let's talk about the show, which I did love.
Okay.
I was like howling at many parts. So it's funny because Christian said, I didn't know what to expect. I think somebody else said it during the break. Mm-hmm. And I guess like I did expect, like this is the story I thought I was going to be told. But I guess, how did you decide, like, because it's vignettes plus a through story,
right,
which is kind of a tough way to do it.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how did that all come together?
Well, it came together because everybody says that they didn't expect it because there's an expectation with Dad's Garage. Like, we're a comedy theater. And so like our last
play was like Benjamin Franklin American Gigolo. And it was all just like, it was stories of like fictional and some true of just of Benjamin Franklin's philandering.
Right.
And so there's literally like Matt Horgan, who wrote that show, when people ask him like, what were the message? He's like, there's no message.
It's Benjamin Franklin American Gigolo.
Yeah. I just wanted to like, I want to do something stupid and dumb and make people laugh. And it did that. And it was great. And so that's what people are kind of used to at Dad. So like this script was super risky for us to do because we don't do drama very much. We don't have like those serious moments in our show. And so I put a lot of the vignettes because they kind of work with the story that I'm trying to tell. But I'm also there because like I want to give you some funny, haha, your dad's garage. But then I'm going to do something that might not be as funny. But just hold on because the funny is coming right after this scene.
Right. But we all know like comedy is hard.
It's very hard.
And when you miss it, it's like uncomfortably bad.
Yes.
Which is why I think it is so enjoyable when something makes you laugh, because then you're laughing that you are laughing because, right? But so, okay, so let's talk about, you're going to create a show and maybe, you know, maybe it's like asking someone about a song and they're like, dude, I don't know, it just fucking comes from me. So I don't know. Like, or people can be too precious about it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like Inside the Actor's Studio type shit. But for you, I guess I want to know, like, obviously it's somewhat autobiographical.
Right, yeah.
And then you're going to have these quote unquote stereotypical characters.
Yes.
So where did you draw the line on, okay, I don't want to, like, I don't want to be too on the nose. That's been done too much.
Right.
Right. The fact that you even have, you even like break fourth wall with grandma and she becomes this device. Mm-hmm. Just all of it worked for me. So talk about it. I don't know what the question is. So.
Okay. Yeah. No, it's no problem. So I have to back up a little bit and just quickly tell you the way that we come up with shows at Dad's Garage is once a year we all get together. You can be a volunteer, you can be a performer, you can be a bartender, and you and we have our pitch meeting and we all get together and anyone can get on stage. You got 5 minutes and you pitch the crowd, this is the show I want to see Dad's Garage do. We all pitch it. At the end of it, we all vote. Whatever gets the top votes, we all, that's the season that we have for the next season.
Okay.
And so for me, I had this idea where I wanted to do this hilarious show where it was like this black guy who got bumped in the head, so now he can only speak in rhymes, but he's really nerdy, and so because of that he accidentally becomes a rapper and like falls into the rap scene.
I like
and,
that story too.
Yeah, it's like it was very, and it was so funny. The Mandy who played the white girl in the play, she was at the, like, I was pitching this idea to some folks, and she was like, it sounds convoluted. I'd rather just see a play about you. And I'm like, I was just like, well, I didn't think anybody would want to know it. So like I started just writing some stuff and I pitched it to the group and everybody was like, yeah, we want to see a play about you. And so I'm like, oh, crap, now I got to write a play about me.
Right.
Yeah. And so at the same time, there's a show called Write Club, Atlanta, that happens in town. And it's all like, it's a literary show. You read a 7-minute essay in front of an audience. And it's not a funny show. Somebody asked me to do it. And it was the first time I tried anything other than comedy. And I was scared out of my wits, but I did it. And it was so cool watching people respond positively to like me just being honest about my life and that sort of thing. And so I was like, okay, can I combine these two ideas of having some like actual exposure of myself on stage and then combine that with my humor and comedy background? And so I tried to mix all those things together. And then just the process of rewriting. Like, I wrote the script in 3 months, but I spent a year rewriting it.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was like stage readings and then private readings and then doing draft after draft after draft until I could get it as smooth and concise as possible.
Was it about like making like the jokes tighter or getting like, did you have to like, what did you get rid of? Like, was there too many vignettes or?
There was, actually it was interesting. There was some of it was like there was not enough vignettes, and so we actually kind of went back and made some more. But honestly, it was kind of, the weird thing was I was literally writing individual stories about my life. These are like experiences that I've had in my life. And as I started writing them, someone was like, oh, great, so you're going to make that a play? It's like, yeah, so like, what's the play about? And I had this existential moment of like, oh, crap, what does it mean? All these experiences that I've had in my life, what does it mean? What's the point of them? Like, what is my life trying to say? And I had the moment of like, ooh, what is meaning? Like, it was just like and so I had to like figure out like, all right, what is the point of all these experiences? And once I like nailed down what the point was, I started like tightening and getting everything to just reinforce that one point through the entire thing.
And then the like the casting process, like clearly good writing, right? Mm-hmm. But then people got to pull it off.
Yeah,
make it sing. Mm-hmm. So what was that like?
That was a learning experience because we had this moment of like we knew Kevin, who's the artistic director here. I sat down and talked and like, who do you want to direct it? And I had a couple of ideas and he's like, you know what? It's a play about race. It should probably be a black person that directs the play. So we're like, all right. And so we're like, yes, let's have a black director. Great. Do you know any black directors? And so we had this moment of like, oh man, we don't know any black directors. And especially we need a black director that could also handle comedy and like understood comedy. And it just worked out that I was on an OKCupid date. I was on a terrible OKCupid date. And Tiffany Porter sat down at the table next to me, and I recognized her from the Shakespeare Tavern. And I'd been in like a couple of dinner parties, and she had just been hilarious. But I knew her training was like Shakespeare acting. And I'm like, well, you've been funny at parties. Maybe. So I just like literally during the date, I just asked my date to stop talking for a second. I just leaned over to Tiffany. I'm like, you don't know me, but would you ever be interested in directing a play? She's like, I'm looking for directing opportunities. And so we're like, all right, this is it.
We have to back up a little bit. Why is one an OKCupid?
Oh, I'm single. So,
but versus Bumble versus the other ones.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm on all of them. I'm going across the board with it. And I've definitely have different experiences with each one of them. I'm probably more of a coffee and bagel man, a Bumble kind of guy. But I'm
guessing, again, 46 years old, yeah. Married before these apps came out. So pretty lame in that world.
Right.
But as opposed to, I'm guessing, the Tinder, just Netflix and chill, or let's meet for a drink and fuck.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So like, yeah, Tinder's like let's like fuck. Okay, Cupid is like I'm an artist, but I don't have money. Binge is like I live in Buckhead, but I'm looking for adventure. And then and Coffee and Bagel's kind of like I'm kind of an artist, but I also have like a full time job. Right. So like that's where I tend to.
I'm not broke AF.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So that's what I do. Which, by the way, being completely honest, I was very excited about having written a play, having it produced, because I'm like, at least I'm going to get laid from this.
And
not once. It was very disappointing in that way.
Don't you got to like have them like bring you out at the end or whatever?
Yeah,
with you?
Yeah. I could have pulled a diva move and been like, Cass, you better bring me out so people know who my face is.
Right.
But yeah. Unfortunately, I have not been able to parlay that into.
But at least now, like you know, you've got that under your thing, right? In your little resume there. Yes. In your little resume.
Exactly.
I mean, so let me ask you, creatively, like artistically, like you have this marketing job, and it clearly, like it's a job, mm-hmm. right? It's a 9-to-5 or whatever,
right?
And it's something that you love and people that you like.
Yeah.
But are you like, man, I secretly hope somebody sees this and wants to make it into a movie?
You know what? Here's the funny thing. I think this is where I'm kind of unique. I'm marketing first, artist second.
Interesting.
Yeah, because I love creating. I love doing art. I love having a fun time. But there is a L.A. man that's born deep inside of me.
Right.
That is like, it's also about the hustle. It's also about the networking. It's also about the self-promotion. And so for me, I'm like, I'm gonna promote this, and I'm going to promote myself as like, hey, this is my giant resume. I can write and I can do things. And it'd be great if this went on to something better, bigger and better. But more than anything, I just want more opportunities to keep doing this.
So you want to just like, okay, what's the next one?
Yep. Let's do the next one.
So you don't, if they like, you wouldn't want to like bring it back next year or?
I actually wouldn't want to bring it back to Dad's next year. Like I would be interested in like having it remounted at another theater or.
Like traveling somewhere?
Traveling somewhere. Like that's our next step is like we're putting together like a pitch package of like a video of the show and the script and like sending it out to other theaters that we have relationships with to see it travel around into the other.
But I do want to get back to the casting a little bit because I do feel like, again, like. Everybody's got to nail it or it doesn't work.
Yes.
So first of all, the lead.
Yes.
Right?
Avery, yep.
So did he, like, when he walked in, we were like, okay, you got it?
No. Like, here's the thing. So half the cast is Dad's Garage improvisers, half of them are just regular actors.
Right.
And so for this show, I wanted to do auditions because I knew some of the stuff was going to be tough. And I also wanted to give some other people a chance that we don't normally see. And Avery came in, and he actually auditioned for Cheeto, which is the tough cousin, because he's physically built for that.
Right.
And he came in, and we just had him just offhanded read for the lead, and he just nailed it. And I'm like, he doesn't have the right physical type. He's too muscular. He's too big. But he just, whatever reason, he nailed that read. And we're like, well, you're big, but you know what? We'll work around it. I'd rather have someone that can nail it than somebody that like looks perfect.
Well, and I talked to the guy that played Cheeto, and he said he came in to read for he said, I'm a nerd.
Yeah. He came for the other part, and he's also like a comedian. It doesn't have like a lot of dramatic
acting. He said it was his first play.
It was his first play. And it was funny because I was with Tiffany, who's like a theater, you know, for the last two decades. And so she would have these people come in, and they would nail it perfectly. They get it perfectly. I'm like, oh, that's awesome. And then Tiffany would be like, now I want you to read it this other way. And the people would struggle, and she's like, I don't want them. And I'm like,
right, they can't adapt.
They can't adapt. They can't take direction.
Right.
And Freddie was one of those guys where he wasn't exactly perfect, but when we asked him to do something, he changed on a dime, and she was like, I can teach him.
But yeah, and that's with any job, by the way. That's any job.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
Because clearly they had rehearsed and were ready to do whatever.
Yep.
But you can always teach them the X's and O's, but you can't teach that ability to roll with the punches and to do like whatever.
Exactly. And so it was a big stretch for all of our improvisers to like do something dramatic, but they were all very teachable and they were willing to work. And then we brought in some professionals to handle some, because like the toughest part was Jonathan, who played the white guy he had the toughest job
because
he had to say some racist things, and then he had to also come back around and you still like him.
Right.
And people could do the racist part, but like when you saw the read, you're like, I can't ever see forgiving you.
Well, so the part that I was uncomfortable, do you know what I'm going to say?
Yeah.
What am I going to say?
Is either the police officer part or the bar part?
Police officer
part. Yep.
No, the bar part was funny. I don't know why that would be uncomfortable. I've been in enough bars.
Yeah.
So even someone as old as me. But the Leafs, and I was like, damn, like, does he want it to be this painful? Like, there was long silences, and it went on a really long time. Yeah. And I was like, well, I'm fucking uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So was that intentional?
That was very
intentional. Does it always play that way?
It always does, and it was very intentional. And that's the only scene in the play that is word for word an experience. So the reason I wanted that was because we had a big debate about that scene, about whether like the police officer pulls a gun or we do something dramatic, very theatery and that sort of thing. And I had a conversation with someone, and they were a white friend, and we were talking about like police harassment, that sort of thing. And they're like, yeah, it's crazy how like it's gone up in the last couple of years. There's so much more police harassment. And it suddenly dawned on me. It's like, wait, no. We just have more video cameras now.
Right.
It's been the same.
Right.
We just have more videos. And so you're seeing it more. And so when you look on their Facebook and you see the videos, there are always the dramatic big events that like work well. And that's what gets passed around. But what I really wanted to do was a scene where it was just every day. It was like there was no like, because that was a moment that actually happened, but I couldn't report that moment. Like, there's nothing to report.
Right.
What am I going to go to the police station and said he asked me some weird questions? No one's going to do anything. No one cares. So it's like, it was just a moment. It was an experience. I had to eat it and be like, well, I'm just going to keep going. And so I wanted to have that feeling. I wanted to create that feeling because for the people of color in the audience, they understood that experience. But what was cool about it was the white people in the audience, they understood that, okay, this is about to be some sort of, and so they're on the edge of their seat and nervous because they're expecting something to happen. They're expecting something dramatic, so they know it's coming. And so it puts everybody on the edge of their seat, like, is it going to happen? Is it going to happen? And it just creates this huge amount of tension, and then it just leaves and nothing happens. And you just have this feeling of like, whoa, that was intense and close and nothing happened. I'm just glad we got through it.
Right.
And that's the feeling that you get when you get pulled over. It's just like, I'm probably like most likely you're not going to have the big dramatic like being choked to death or like something like that. But like that every day that happens where it's just like I'm feeling super tense and this could go so many ways. And they're asking some weird questions, but I got to keep smiling and saying yes, sir. And just push my way through it. I wanted that experience.
Well, I would say that's fucking impressive then, because that's, you know, and I'm like, I feel like I'm not an easy audience, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm certainly like, you know, as, what's the word, snarky and as fucking eye roll as anybody. And you got me. I mean, like I said, I was wicked uncomfortable. And I was asking, I'm sorry, what's the guy's name that played Cheeto?
Oh, Freddie. Freddie.
Freddie.
Yep.
Because he knows Christian. Mm-hmm. And I was saying, like, wow, this crowd was great. You know, is it like this every night? And he was saying how, like, Friday night's more ITP, Saturday night's more OTP.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that.
Yeah, it's a real thing. And so what happens is it's that last minute thing. So if you're in town on your Friday night, you've been working all day. Like, if you live 5 minutes from the theater, you'd be like, eh, I'm bored at 7. Let's go over to Dad's Garage and see something.
Right.
But, like, if you live in Marietta and it's a, like, 45-minute drive.
Or Alpharetta.
Like, yeah, Alpharetta. Yeah, you're going to plan out where you go, and you're not going to do something right after you've been working for all day. So what tends
probably
going to
be a dinner before or
exactly,
dinner after.
Yeah. So what happens is if they're outside the perimeter, they come on Saturdays because they have the day to plan and they have the whole thing. And so it creates a real interesting sort of difference in the audience because it tends to have the age is different because of that factor. Politically, the audience is different because of that factor. And so there are certain shows that we do, real political shows that we do, where it's a very apparent that, like, on Friday they love it, Saturday they hate it. So it's very apparent and very clear. But on
uh-oh, we got issues.
Okay. Great. All right,
we can move again, man. I'm flexible.
Okay, cool. Okay, yeah, we'll hang out. We'll move from there.
Is that the park ranger?
Sorry, I should have introduced him. That's Kevin. He's our artistic director.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
He looks like the park ranger.
He does look like a park ranger. He has a very park ranger look. But yeah, it creates this different audience between a Friday and a Saturday. And it's been interesting because I feel like that Saturday, I was really concerned about that Saturday audience. I didn't know how the Saturday audience would respond to the show. And they've responded well. And they're willing to go along with it. And I think part of it is that the play doesn't feel like I have a big, like, preachy thing.
No, I didn't think so. I did notice there were not a lot of black people the night that I went. And I came with a black person.
Yeah.
But I did notice. I was like, oh, I kind of expected.
Well, the reality is Dad's Garage has tends to pull in a white audience just in general. And so it was funny because as the run went further, the audience got blacker because more and more African-Americans were telling other African-Americans about it because, like, a lot of folks had never been here, never thought of it. I was explaining it like, you know, the Cheetah could do a day that's focused on, like, community and street repair at their location, but you're never going to look on the Cheetah's Facebook page for, you know, a community event at the Cheetah because, like, the Cheetah's for strippers. That's where strippers go.
I was like, why is he talking about wildlife animals?
Yeah, no, sorry. The Cheetah, the strip club.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, like, because you never think to go to look at Cheetah, the strip club for a community.
You'd hear about it, but through some other
means. So, yeah. So it's the same reason for Dad's Garage. We're like, that's not.
Whereas the lion is always putting on really nice.
Yeah.
Like, what? That's Cheetah.
Cheetah. And so, like, it built an audience. Yeah.
So I totally lost my train of thought. I mean, we're pretty good at wrapping up. So has the show had its run? Is it over?
So the show is over, and, like, the next stage in its process is now we're looking for theaters that are willing to remount it and take it. And the hope and the belief is that it had a great run here.
Right.
If it's produced at another theater, that theater will have a great run, and then other theaters will start having a great run with this play, and it'll make its way around America and hopefully at some point end up in New York, and then it can go on from there.
Is it like music publishing where, like, you get a cut? How does that work?
No, so the play is, and that's one of the very cool things about Dad's Garage. If we make something here, we have an IP policy where it is 100% the creators. So the only cut that Dad's Garage asks for is that if you produce it somewhere else, in the brochure you say it was premiered.
I mean, you personally.
So, yeah. So, for me, it's 100% mine. So, I own the play. So, if another theater wants to do it, they will have to pay me.
Okay,
because,
like, I didn't know how that works.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yep. That's how it works.
Cool. I was going to ask you something. Oh, So I completely missed the Back to the Future joke. Mm-hmm. Whatever happened, there was this huge laugh and I missed it. So, and I can't believe I just remembered it. So now you have to tell me what actually happens.
Okay. So the idea is the way that I connected all the vignettes was this idea of race changes the story.
Right.
If you just change the race of the character and then you take a classic movie or something like that, it completely changes that movie.
Right.
So Back to the Future was the first example of that.
Right.
Where if Marty McFly is black, what does that mean?
Right.
So we do the classic beginning of Back to the Future where Doc Brown comes by and is like, Marty, your parents are in trouble. And Marty's like, all right, what do we got to do? He's like, we got to go back in time. He's like, to when? 1955. And Marty goes, yeah, they're in fucking trouble. It's 1955. They're black. That's, yeah. So well, like, it's like,
see,
yeah.
It, actually, the joke still works.
Yeah. Yeah. This is like, yeah, of course they're in trouble. That's
all
the whole
right.
joke.
All right. So Dragon Con is around the corner.
Yep.
What do you have a plan for every day? Do you do a different costume every day?
No.
Will you be He-Man? Not Black He-Man, but just He-Man?
All right. So this is the most hippy dippy that I get, and it's only with Dragon Con.
Okay.
So I believe that. So there have been a couple years where I like planned it like 6 months in advance. I have my costume, I've ordered, I've tailor-made everything, and I get there, and there was 1 year, and I like really put a lot of work in my costume, and only the janitor recognized me. No one else recognized what costume I was wearing, and I'm like, well, that's crappy. And then this last year, I'm not doing anything, and like a week before, a friend was like, I have an extra mermaid costume if you want it, and I'm like, well, slap a red wig on me and some shells, I'm Ariel.
Right.
And so I went as Ariel last year. So this year I'm just going to be like, you know what? I'm just going to go. And if a costume pops into my head and I can throw some things together, I'll do it. Otherwise, yeah, just have fun.
You know what that reminds me of? That reminds me of like when you go home and you plan you're away from the town you live in and you plan a trip back and you try to see everybody and you plan these lunches and everything and it becomes a clusterfuck. So the next time you go back home, you go, you know what? If it ends up, I'm just going to say I'm in town. Whoever's around for coffee, meet me for coffee.
That's exactly
well, right. So the janitor recognized you as what?
Oh, I was, well, it is also because it's an old reference. I was Turbo from a Breaking 2 Electric Boogaloo.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah. No one got, I had the whole broom on like a fishling line.
So when he's like showing him like the dance moves?
Yeah, the dance moves and everything. So, like, I thought it was hilarious. I thought it was great. No one recognized me.
You were talking to a child of the 80s where Breaking 2 is like, I don't know, Gone with the Wind, Chicago.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I thought it was a great one, and no one recognized it. So,
all right. I might have to do some sort of Breaking 2. Okay, I'm going to get your opinion on this because I've started to have this conversation. So, I'm curious what your thoughts are on this. And then I'll give you the Atlanta favorites quiz, and then we'll wrap it up.
Cool.
So maybe if they can just wait until we're done, we'll be good.
Cool.
I was talking to the guys at Joystick because I interviewed them right after going to their spot,
right.
And I want to do my show there.
Mm-hmm.
And I told them, you know, there's how, you know, nerdy things are king now, and there's every culture, everything's got a Funko, right? And I'm like, you know what I'm really into is Law and Order.
Yes.
And everybody loves Law and Order.
Yes.
And if you're traveling, it's on the hotel room. What do you think if I did like a little mini Law and Order con?
I would go to there.
Yes.
I would buy tickets.
Awesome.
I would be, oh my gosh, that would be awesome.
They were totally not, they were looking at me weird.
Really?
And they're the Joystick Bar nerd guys.
No, you could absolutely do a Law and Order con.
Awesome. Can we, maybe we could do it together maybe?
Yes, I will cosplay because so many, I could have a costume for every single, it would be different suits, but still. It would just
right,
be.
So who do you like? Like who are your like favorite detectives? Who do you like on the law side?
Oh, it was, what's his name? He was the lawyer for like most of the run and he does like insurance commercials now.
Oh, Jack McCoy, the old guy?
Yeah, Jack McCoy, yeah.
Right.
That he was, I loved him. He was so cool.
Right?
Yeah, he was like absolutely one of my favorites. And then, I'm also bad with names, but then there was the cop, he's the young black cop, and not Ice, Because Ice Cube was on Special Victims.
No, Ice-T is on Special Victims. Yeah. Look at you not knowing the difference between Ice Cube and Ice-T.
See, this is...
You are a black nerd.
I am. Absolutely.
And Ice Cube lived like 20 minutes from you.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's terrible.
Coming straight out of Compton.
Yeah, it's funny because I'm thinking of this guy and I can't remember his name. And the only thing I can think of is he was in Rent, the musical. And like he was in the first Broadway run and he was in
the
movie.
I know you're talking about. He's great.
He was great.
He had the old white guy partner who was making bad jokes.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's
yes.
Lenny, and I can't think of his name either. But here's something hilarious for those of you who haven't seen the first season in a long time. My TiVo tapes them all, so I just watch whatever.
Oh, yeah.
So they're showing the first season, and it's like it's bad, but not even in the way that now they're kind of bad and cheesy. Like 1990, it may as well be 1978. The racism, the sexism,
oh, wow.
Like the writing. Like, oh, it's kind of like the jokes they make, and you're like, you can't say that. And this is 1990, which we think is pretty progressive.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, watch some TV shows from 1990.
Oh, man.
Like, every time they talked about this prostitute, they always said whorehouse.
Oh, no.
Like, it's just, nobody says whorehouse anymore.
That's just an old-timey thing.
Right, but this is 1990. Yeah. Anyway, I highly recommend it. All right, let's do the Atlanta favorite. Okay,
gotcha.
So, what is your go-to order at the Waffle House?
Oh, my go-to order is... grits and sausage. I'm basic. I should just say that. I'm super basic.
Are you a basic biatch?
Yes, absolutely. I will own that title.
Is it on your Tinder, Bumble?
It should
thing?
Be. It should be. It's on my business cards. But yeah, just give me some sausage and some hash browns and some grits and I'm good.
Okay. What is your favorite restaurant in Atlanta currently?
Manuel's Tavern.
Oh, wow. He said that quickly.
Oh, yeah. I know exactly what it is.
So that's old school.
Yep. Old school. But I love it because I like talking to people.
Right.
And it's one of the few places that there's never a wait. There's always a good table and there's always a great place where you can easily have a conversation without talking loud or talking over someone.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Rank these in importance to you.
Okay.
Falcons, United, Braves, Hawks.
I'm going to say Falcons first. Recently, it's been a tough one between the Hawks and United, but I'll say United second, Hawks third, Braves fourth.
Everybody, all the ITPers are like so down on the Braves.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, they're fine, but like I just, you know, I just not a baseball guy. I never had a big baseball love.
Right. Okay. Finish this sentence.
Okay.
I take MARTA blank.
For Falcons games. That is literally the only reason I use it.
Okay. Yeah. Very common answer. Other one being the airport, right?
Oh, yeah.
Airport's number one.
Okay.
Or airports might be number two, almost never. If this was like, if this was whatchamacallit. What's that game show?
Oh, yeah. Family Feud.
Right.
Just like the closest, like
exactly.
The most popular answer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Do you shower every morning or every night?
Every night.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What is the best festival in Atlanta?
Ooh, that's actually a tough one because there are so many festivals right now. The one that I think I enjoy probably the most. Ooh, this is a real Homer answer.
It's okay.
But Bacon Fest.
Do you guys put it on?
Yeah.
Then
yeah.
You can't pick that one.
Okay. Ah, oh, crap. That was such an okay. Then my other one is 420 Fest. Wow, crud. Here's the thing. It used to be great. I used to love 420 Fest, but now it's become one of those giant festivals that probably the Jazz Fest. Because like I just like a low key festival where it's not A, it doesn't cost an arm and a leg to get in, and then B, I can drink and sit outside.
I will show you a flyer. I found a bunch of cool stuff in my attic, and I have this flyer 1992. It was called the Pot Fest back then. And the Black Crowes played.
Oh, wow.
And I want to say that Cypress Hill played, but there might have been another year. Anyway, I'll show you a little photo.
Wow, that's crazy.
Right? Old school, right?
Oh, that's
the real
yeah,
deal.
Yeah, yeah.
And what's the best concert you've seen in Atlanta?
The best concert? God, I'm an idiot. You know what? I'm an old man, and Weezer came through a few years ago, and
right.
I was a huge Weezer fan, so I saw them live, and so that was my favorite concert that
I don't
I've
think
seen.
There's anything lame about Weezer. I think Weezer is pretty, like, across the board, everybody loves Weezer.
Yeah, I like a good Weezer concert.
Okay, the final question is, are you ready?
Yep.
Who should I have next on the Atlanta podcast?
Ooh, that is a great question. You know who I would say the person you should have next. Have you ever had a man named Mark Kendall?
No.
You should have Mark Kendall on. He's a fascinating human being that worked for a little while on the Chris Rock show when he had an HBO show.
Right.
And he does sketch comedy here. And he did a show here that is the only show that the Alliance Theater, which is the big, took and remounted because they love the show so much.
Okay.
Yeah. So he's a very cool guy.
Okay. You want to shout out links or Instagrams or anything?
Yeah. You can follow me on yeah, probably Facebook's the easiest place to hit me up. John Carr, JONCARR.
Right.
Yeah.
You don't want to pimp the your marketing job for
Dad's Garage? Oh, yeah. Also, Dad's Garage. I'm terrible at my job. I'm usually performing here. So we have shows Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, 8 o'clock and 10:30. Improv shows, scripted shows. It's always funny. So come on down.
All right. Well, listen. Since they can't see the show anymore, just know that the quality was amazing. I'm a tough critic, so come down here and see stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, good talk.
Thanks.
It was a nice chat at Dad's Garage. Let me remind you, drop me a note, will you? Or, you know what, leave a review. We haven't had a review left in a long time. I don't put a ton, like I'm not like hitting you guys every week saying, please leave. This week I'm asking. If you enjoy the podcast, if it's brought you value, if it's brought you a nice commute or a nice jog or whatever you do where you put these things in your ears, go to that Purple Podcast app and type a review. You can even do it on the page. If you can't figure out that, go to the Atlanta Podcast Facebook page, which we don't use a ton. Leave something there, and I'll read it on the show. How about that? You can also find us, ATL Podcast, on Instagram. We are the Critics Pick 2018 Creative Loafing Best Podcast in Atlanta. Thank you so much, CL, for that nod. Maybe I should have mentioned that at the beginning. I don't know. Gonna keep bringing you these week in, week out. Sorry they haven't been a steady stream of days like every blah blah day, but I brought you at least once a week. Okay, I hope you're enjoying cooler weather in the ATL. Have fun at Halloween parties, whatever the heck you do. Again, not a thing my wife and I do. People get all dressed up. They put on their sexy costume or their goofy costume or their whatever costume with their family. I'm pretty low-key. We trick-or-treat in our neighborhood for a couple hours, sometimes with neighbor kids, sometimes just our kids. We're just low-key people, what can I say? Drop me a note somewhere. Love you, Miss You Mean It. I gotta run.